with Scott Allen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in this beautiful world. I am your host, Scott J. Allen, and this is Phronesis, Practical Wisdom for Leaders. Now, I am a professor of management at John Carroll University in Cleveland, Ohio, USA. In addition, I'm a husband and father of three teens. Now, this is a family endeavor. Will played the intro, Kate voiced the intro, and who knows, you may hear from Emily a little later. I'm also an author, entrepreneur, speaker, and co-founder of the Collegiate Leadership Competition. I love to travel, explore new places with family, and learn from others. Phronesis offers a smart, fast-paced discussion about all things leadership and followership, if we're honest. My guests are scholars and practitioners, and we cover relevant topics and incorporate practical tips designed to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. I am proud to share a few updates. According to Listen Notes, Phronesis is listed as among the top 3% of podcasts in the world because of you. So thank you. In addition, the podcast has two sponsors. First, Phronesis is the official podcast of the International Leadership Association, an association that is near and dear to my heart. ILA brings together leaders and those who teach, study, and develop leadership, advancing leadership knowledge and practice for a better world. Learn more at ila-net.org. My second sponsor is the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. At Bowler, we offer several advanced degrees and MBAs, and I'm confident that there's one that will fit your location, interests, and timeline. In fact, our online MBA is ranked as the number one in Ohio and number nine in the United States. We offer international study tours, a contemporary and forward-looking curriculum, and access to senior leaders and flagship organizations. Learn more at business.jcu.edu. You can find links to both sponsors in the show notes. Now, if you like what we're up to, please hit subscribe so you can stay current as we release new episodes each week. You can also share what we're up to with others, friends, colleagues, leaders, teams, students, and others you think will benefit. And now, today's show. Okay, everybody, welcome to Phronesis. Thank you so much for checking in wherever you are in the world. Today, I have a return guest, Dr. Martin Gutman. And, you know, we had just this wonderful conversation. If you have not checked out that episode, early on in the podcast, we talked, and it was just a really fun conversation. He is a Swiss-American historian and professor at the Lucerne School of Business in Switzerland. His recent work includes Before the UN Sustainable Development Goals, A Historical Companion, which came out in 2022 with Oxford University Press, and just out, The Unseen Leader, How History Can Help Us Rethink Leadership. Martin, I again go back to our conversation often. I think it was really the first time, and I've had a few historians on the program in recent years. I just really love the perspective, and I love this strand of how we can explore the topic of leadership. So I'm excited to have the conversation today. What else do listeners need to know about you before we jump in and begin the conversation?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back. I had a really good time the first time around. What was that, 2 or 3 years ago?
Yes.
Maybe even something like that. And I do still listen to your show, even before I was on the first time, regularly, because you do bring in so many different perspectives on leadership, not just the historical one. So it's enriching, and that's why I'm happy to be back and have another discussion with you. What else do people need to know about me? I'm not sure. You know, I'm the traditional academic, love teaching, love the research I do, love the writing, and have a couple hobbies on the side and three kids that keep me pretty busy. So that's my life in a nutshell.
Well, if I remember correctly, there was running in mountains, if I'm not mistaken. Is that accurate? It's in your past, at least, correct?
That is accurate. As I'm getting older, I'm finding running a bit harder, but I am still doing my best to make it up and back down. As you get older, it's the down part that tends to hurt more than the up part. So when you're running up and down mountains. But yeah, I do my best to get out.
That's never been a part of my, when you're running up and down mountains. I love it. Okay.
I suppose it depends on where you live. That's really what kind of running you do.
Switzerland's probably pretty good for that. Well, okay. So your new book is called The Unseen Leader, How History Can Help Us Rethink Leadership. So talk a little bit about the unseen leader. What do you mean by that? I'm kind of interested and intrigued.
Yeah, so I really make just one point in this book. And that is that we, or I challenge us to rethink how we talk about leadership, how we think about leadership. And so rather than getting into the details or the psychology of what a leader is up to when the decision-making process and the impact that has on followers, I try to take a step back and just think about what's the story that we intuitively tell when we think about a leader? What's this kind of rote narrative that we grasp for if we want to think about a leader? And maybe a bit to the origin story first of this book. I have a PhD in history, as you mentioned, but I have for over a decade worked in management departments. It's kind of a quirk of my career, and I've quite enjoyed it. So I think that's where I'm happy from now on, but it's not what I imagined early in my career. But long story short, I was tasked very much last minute at one point by a dean, this was at a different school, to teach a course on leadership because the person who normally taught it was unavailable last minute. And so, you know, I said, yeah, I can do that. That's interesting. And I started reading everything I could get my hands on regarding leadership from journals and books and everything else. And one of the things that caught my attention was that using historical figures as kind of case studies, as inspiration, as the fodder for leadership theories, quite prominent, actually, not just among historians, but, you know, these historical figures, Churchill and Shackleton and Napoleon, and they appear in pamphlets from consulting firms, they appear in all kinds of leadership blogs, and so on and so forth. So that was interesting to me as a historian. But I also realized pretty early on that some of the assumptions that I make as a historian about how individuals can shape history differ dramatically from the assumptions inherent in a lot of these texts. And my take was that the truly influential individuals and what it is they do to shape kind of the outcome of events is a bit harder to spot, therefore the unseen part in my title. And the book is really an attempt to, you know, shed light on these leaders that have gone unnoticed to some extent, because often what they do is something we don't necessarily recognize as leadership.
Mm. Well, and I remember our first conversation where you were really just kind of blowing my mind about Roald Amundsen. And here's an individual who has accomplished incredible feats, absolutely just incredible. And we had never heard of him. And so interesting, so interesting. And as I understand it, I think we touched on this a little bit last time, but history, or that stream of knowledge, at least historically, has tended to decenter the person or the individual and focus a little bit more on the context, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. In my new book, I used this example of a river, and we can imagine the leader trying to cross this river.
Hmm.
And if there's a strong current, it's going to be these currents much more than any individual movements of the leader that will determine where he or she ends up on the other side.
Hmm.
And it's really the leader's interaction with these currents that's going to make or break their endeavor rather than their actions themselves. And this is where I think there's a bit of this gap between the leaders we tend to focus on and the leaders we should be focusing on. You know, if somebody haphazardly jumps into the water, almost drowns, is making a bunch of noise, looking back in history, we tend to say, wow, that's the leader, because this guy, he's really going for it. He's, you know, everybody's attention is on this person. Whereas it might really be somebody who doesn't have to generate a lot of this excess noise, looks very steady, who finds the perfect way of interacting with these currents and makes it across without a lot of drama and a lot of fuss. And in terms of polar exploration, you're absolutely right. We talked about slat time. Roald Amundsen was this explorer who was just stunningly successful, consistently so, but his expeditions were always or nearly always drama-free. So they make for bad reading. Therefore, you know, he doesn't make it into a lot of these case studies that are so popular at Harvard Business School and elsewhere. The explorers who kind of fumbled into things, made a lot of noise, had a lot of drama, and then somehow managed to extricate themselves in the end, they're the, you know, the leadership examples that are profiled in a lot of these case studies that are still used to this day.
Well, and is that kind of dancing around the action fallacy that you talk about in the book?
Yeah, that's the term that I kind of give to our, I would say it's our mistaken belief that leadership is characterized by movement and energy and drive and boldness in the face of harrowing odds. This lively action and this boldness is actually a testament to somebody's leadership medal. So I find that to be false. And I don't suggest that being able to respond to a crisis isn't a good thing, you know, for a leader to be able to do. Even just looking more recently, you know, Zelensky in Ukraine, I think when Russia launched this awful invasion, everybody, including the US, was expecting the Ukrainian leadership to flee. You know, when they in fact offered, you know, Biden offered Zelensky a ride out, said, well, we'll pick you up. You can relocate in the US. You know, it's over anyway. And he's like, no, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to fight it out. And I know that this comes at great risk to me, to my family, and so on. And so in that case, you know, he's staring danger in the face. That's brilliant. But that doesn't explain why Ukraine is still to this day successfully prosecuting this war. So there's a lot more at work if we examine a longer period that, you know, is a true testament to the leadership and management skills at work. So that's a little bit of what I'm going for in the book. What I would also say is in terms of, you know, a crisis, and Shackleton here is a case in point, this famous British explorer whose journey on the Endurance is kind of a pillar of historical leadership studies. I found in my research that a significant portion of the crisis that he was faced with was self-inflicted or could have been avoided or was avoided by other explorers such as Amundsen. And then we have to ask ourselves, you know, is the leader who kind of creates his own crisis and then manages to extricate him or herself the person we want to hold up as a role model and learn from? Or is it the leader who just doesn't end up in that many crisis situations? I would say the latter.
Yes. You do touch on Rold in this book, and that's great. Are there some other individuals that maybe listeners haven't heard of? And I'm not asking you to go super in depth on them, but who are some of these individuals who just kind of quietly went about their work, did incredible things, and changed some of that course of history, like Amundsen had?
Yeah, so in the end, I ended up profiling only four leaders in this book. This was, you know, a decision I had to make as a writer. More examples would kind of give a broader pool of context and time periods. So there would have been a certain value in that. On the other hand, because I really prioritize us as the observer understanding the complexity of the context and understanding how the individual leader interacted with that, how they understood it, et cetera, it requires quite a bit of writing. You can't do this superficially. And therefore, to keep it at a book length, you know, four was really the maximum that I could do. So it's really four, you know, biographical studies, if you will, under one roof. And so in addition to Amundsen, whom we also discussed at length last time, I profile Toussaint Louverture, who led the only truly successful slave revolt. This was on the island that would later become Haiti, against the most powerful European empires, the British, the Spanish, and France under Napoleon. And, you know, he started off as an illiterate slave and worked his way up to be both a military and a political leader who, in my mind, stands out as one of the most competent in this period.
Hmm.
Now, of course, there are several reasons why he is not profiled as often as, you know, Napoleon and Washington and these other leaders of this revolutionary period. He was a contemporary of theirs. I think the first one is, you know, racism, that the history books in France and the US in the aftermath were obviously written by usually white men who tended to profile people who looked like them. But I think there's more to it as well, which is that he doesn't quite conform to this heroic Shackleton type leader. He was a big proponent of retreats. He negotiated a lot. And, you know, so he's not the military leader always leading from the front with a saber in his hand.
Yes.
And so, you know, he's not Hollywood-like material in that sense. He doesn't conform to the action fallacy, as I would call it. So he's another person I profile in the book. Then I look at Gertrude Bell, who was a remarkable woman and an explorer who kind of mapped large areas of the deserts in the Middle East and in the period before and after the First World War. And in the aftermath of that war, as these various European empires, but also Zionists and a lot of local tribes were trying to reconstruct a region in the aftermath of the war, she emerges. Well, she doesn't emerge. She remains very much behind the shadows. But in hindsight, we can see that she really leads the effort of creating an independent Arab state that's built on pretty sound principles of good governance, etc. In, you know, our recollection of this period, the person who stands out is T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, as he's called. Again, classic Hollywood-esque leader, you know, a gun in his hand, leading from a camelback. But he himself admits in his writing that it was really Bell who did the behind-the-scenes heavy lifting in this period. So she's another one I profile. And then the fourth person is Churchill. And Churchill's kind of a special case because I think he's picked out by many people as the great leader or one of the great leaders of the 20th century. So what am I suggesting by including him in a book titled The Unseen Leader? And with Churchill, I would say he really was the architect or one of the primary architects of the Allied success in the Second World War, but not for the reasons that are often, you know, cited. Huh. And again, I think this action fallacy here is at work. There's this interpretation, especially in a lot of movies about Churchill and some of the more popular writing, that it was his charisma, his speeches, and his speeches are great, that this is what kind of inspired this reluctant nation to fight on. This gave them the strength and the vision to stick it out. And that it's also what's often cited. It's his kind of hounding of his generals. Again, this action-prone attitude. There's lots of great quotes by Churchill. There's a very, you know, famous quote, and famous in the sense that it's often appearing on LinkedIn threads, et cetera, by Churchill, in which he says, "I never worry about action, only inaction." Right. So it's really easy to read into Churchill's success his penchant for the offensive, for always kind of speaking in grand strokes and kind of hounding people to get things done. And he did all of these things. And that was certainly valuable in leading Britain to a successful outcome in the war. But, you know, if grand words alone could win wars, then Hitler and Mussolini would have won, because they were, even more so than Churchill, the masters of rhetoric, of energizing an audience, etc. So I think there's a lot of misinterpretations about Churchill and his role. And I think if we look behind the scenes, and a lot of recent works on Churchill tend to support this conclusion, is that there were two factors that ultimately led to a successful outcome in the war. Mm. That was that he was able to, in his own words, drag the United States into it. And, you know, looking back, we kind of tend to take that for granted. Yes, of course, the U.S. would join Britain in the war and fight against this Nazi threat. But in the summer of 1940, when, you know, Britain had lost its fighting partner, France, and was kind of facing Germany on its own. On its own, too, is a bit of the wrong term, since they have the whole British Empire. But let's leave that point behind for a second. So in the summer of 1940, it's by no means sure that the U.S. Was going to do anything about this situation in Europe. There's a strong isolationist movement. And after Pearl Harbor, natural inclination will be for the U.S. to focus solely on Japan.
Yeah.
And that's really, you know, Churchill's doings. He launches a very, very deliberate, what we today would call an advocacy campaign, to build support among the political class in the U.S., among the population, and among Roosevelt, for a U.S. entry into this war. And then Churchill also is very deliberate and, you know, puts a lot of energy into creating an effective coordinating mechanism between these two allied armies, which again is not something you take for granted when two sovereign states, you know, fight together. And they really were able to fight together, you know, with a lot of generals and officers working in the services of the other countries. So that's the one thing. And the other thing is, more than any other leader in that war, he understands the interplay between science, between effective governance, and kind of grand strategy. This isn't a war that can be won by rhetoric, by inspiration. You really have to leverage industrial production, new scientific insights, and couple that with a long-term strategy. And that's something that he, more than the other leaders, is able to master. Also, thanks to the fact that he'd been in government for some 40 years, he had essentially been a minister in most, you know, most briefs of the British government. So he understood this machinery better than anybody else.
Well, I like how you're framing that, because I think you're right. A lot of times we don't, even within that very public example of a leader, quote unquote, we don't necessarily explore the complexity or the nuance of that individual's expertise or actions. We tend to oversimplify it into, oh, he gave this speech and it was wonderful and that was just awesome, right? I mean, even if you look at, and I know that you have an expertise in Nazi Germany, I think it was on Netflix. I watched Hitler's Inner Circle. I don't know if you've seen this documentary, but, you know, underneath Hitler was this group of individuals who were horribly atrocious characters in their own right and moving that vision forward, right? We often don't give credit to, and I use that word not in a positive way, but, you know, Hitler is the person who's held up, and there's this team around him of individuals who are horrible and did great damage in their own right. Would you agree?
I would agree entirely on a few different levels. And I do talk a bit about Hitler as well, in contrast to Churchill, in the sense that they both, you know, were great charismatic leaders, were able to inspire people through their words. But Hitler is a relatively incompetent manager, you know, and is disinterested in the functioning of government, doesn't understand how to turn his vision into policy. And he usually resorts to just yelling at people when the things he wants to happen don't happen. And you're right that, you know, especially if we look at something like the Holocaust, obviously, this is something Hitler set his sights on, the extermination of the European Jewish population and many other groups of people. And he put a lot of kind of personal energy into making it happen. But it could not have happened with him alone. There were really a lot of highly motivated and highly skilled leaders and managers below him who made it happen. So you're absolutely right there. And I think maybe taking a step back and just discussing a more general question, I mean, I know that in some leadership literature, there's this distinction made between leadership and management. I think it was John Cotter who wrote that leadership is about dealing with change, management is about dealing with complexity. I think that's a useful kind of analytical perspective to take, to acknowledge that certain roles require perhaps more competencies in the other than the former, and certain people are better at one or the other. But I would say in real life, you know, you need both, and they're often very intermeshed. It's kind of hard to separate them entirely. That's a bit of an artificial exercise. And I see that with these leaders I look at, and other ones, when we talked about Zelensky as well, that to be successful, you really have to master, both of these hats. You have to be able to wear both hats.
Well, that would be an interesting kind of strand we could go down right now. What's interesting is, okay, let's look at Rold for a moment. Probably incredible manager, incredible at locking down the details, locking down the specifics. You know, we're going to hunker down here for 6 months, actually get to know the people, learn from them, you know, there's insane levels of strategy there. But maybe he was less interested in some of that public self-promotion, you know, making a big deal of this is what I've accomplished. And, you know, some of that action fallacy where you have some individuals who may have fallen into some of that and then they're self-promoting. So it's so interesting, right? It's just, I wonder if some of these individuals were, I think of him in the very limited knowledge that I have, right? as maybe someone who is very interested in the puzzle and the work of getting that done and less so interested in the fame or the notoriety or some of those elements of that work. Not that all leaders are interested in fame and notoriety, but back to your distinction of leader manager, it would be really fun because I imagine, again, he was an incredible leader and the fact that he could influence these individuals to really push through, because that was not easy work, right?
No, that's absolutely right. And I think his case or polar exploration, you know, really demonstrates that both of these competencies or skill sets are very much intermeshed. Like if you're a bad planner or a bad manager, you know, things will go wrong when you enter these very icy and cold waters up north or down south. But yeah, there's a leadership challenge that, you know, things are not going to turn out the way you thought they would. You have to lead. At this time, it was men primarily, you know, through very harrowing experiences. You have to keep motivation high. So these things go hand in hand. And you're right that Amundsen was less concerned with promoting himself. He got better at it, or he became more interested in it over the course of his career, because he realized that this, you know, as his goals got bigger, he required more funding, and he did not have the Royal Geographic Society or some other large London-based institution support him, the Royal Navy, etc. So he had to come up with a lot of the money himself through investors and kind of smaller foundations. So having a bit of a public profile certainly helped. But what becomes clear when you read about his life is that he was the opposite of a lot of the British explorers who liked the exploring side because of the access and the prestige it gave them when they were back in London. Mm. You know, they liked the idea of being an explorer more than actually being out there. And for him,
Months on the ice with the locals.
Exactly, yeah. And for Amundsen, you really get the sense through his writing and the people who are, you know, were with him on these trips and writing about him, that he is in his element and he would much rather be out there somewhere in the ice than at home dealing with paperwork, you know, or paying bills or giving speeches. But I don't want to suggest that leaders who build a public profile are necessarily bad or poor leaders. No, I think it's just that is in and of itself not what sets leaders apart. You know, Churchill was very deliberate and about how he built his own image from an early age on, and you know was a prolific writer, liked to put himself as a center of that writing. So he was keenly aware of how he could shape his legacy. Gertrude Bell, on the other hand, you know, refused the interview request that she got. She was completely disinterested in that. And L'Ouverture, the other, you know, main character I look at, falls somewhere in between. I think when it had a strategic purpose, he would write op-eds to newspapers. But this was also a different time where, you know, people didn't have LinkedIn accounts and Instagram accounts. But again, I think it's a nice to have in certain scenarios if you know how to brand yourselves, but it is not always the key mark of somebody who is a good leader.
Well, there's a, at least in our world right now, as we're kind of exploring some of these topics, I mean, my mind goes to the word intentionality, and that, you know, I may not be disposed to be an incredible manager. Am I aware of that? Am I open to having that knowledge? And do I make up for that by having people on the team who have that skill? And then am I open enough to listen to those individuals when perhaps, you know, my perspectives are limited or my perspectives are not what the knowledge that's needed in the situation? I'm about to start Musk's biography, the Isaacson biography of Musk. And that's at least an interesting couple of the interviews that I've watched. Here's an individual who's almost micromanaging the details, has this grand vision, but is also an individual who is not necessarily known as someone who will take feedback. People are afraid to give him the bad news. There's fear. And that's going to take a very special individual to work through that with him so that he stays open and understanding of some of the situational complexities that he might be missing, because we all suffer from, what is it, 180 cognitive biases that limits our ability to actually make sense of the world.
Yeah.
You got to have a certain level of humility here. And, you know, absolutely, to your point, if I'm Hitler and I'm just yelling at people and screaming when things aren't going, then that causes fear and that causes distrust, and that limits you from seeing the realities and the context. Thankfully so in that case, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, indeed. No, and I think that's the sad truth, is that toxic leaders can and have accomplished a lot before their toxic leadership style catches up with them.
Yes.
At which point their projects tend to fall apart.
Yes.
But that is unfortunate that some of these characters, and I would say the jury's still out with Musk in terms of his vision. I mean, Tesla's been a great success, but I think success also has to be measured in how he makes the people who work for him feel, the impact he has on society in general. And there I'd say the jury is still out.
100%. 100%. I mean, there's a sustainability element here that, if, you know, what are the sustainable behaviors? To go to a US-centric example, you have John Wooden, who is a famous basketball coach, very successful, UCLA.
Yes.
Had a very sustainable approach to coaching. And you have a Bobby Knight, where it fires bright and hot, but it's not necessarily a sustainable approach, right? And
yeah.
So it's just very, very interesting, the conversation. How are you planning to use this in the classroom? Because, Martin, I love the perspective. In some ways, it pushes back on some of these myths that we can fall into. And I think the reality is that there's all shades of individuals, whether it's someone who is completely uneducated, quote unquote, formally, and really rose to the highest levels, or someone who isn't necessarily interested in the notoriety or the fame, or someone who can combine not only the policy and the management and the just understanding of the different levers that need to be pulled, but then also stand up and give the speech to motivate the masses in Churchill. It's all shades, right? And you're pushing back on this common narrative, and I really enjoy that.
Something that I really do hope to integrate into my teaching, especially in, you know, executive education programs and settings where I get to interact with people who lead in very complex organizations and at a very high level already. And I think what I'm hoping to do there is to challenge them to rethink how they assess leadership potential in others and also in themselves. You know, I call it the action fallacy in my book, this idea that we, you know, tend to look to the persons who make the most noise and kind of, you know, generate the most activity in their teams as the natural leaders, when in fact, very effective leaders might not need to generate a lot of noise. There might not be any drama, et cetera. And there's actually a lot of, you know, literature outside of the historical domain that gets to this point as well. There's the Babel hypothesis, which has been quite popular in recent years, that suggests that the person who talks the most, regardless of what they're saying, will be identified by others as a leader. Mm. Keith Grint has written about a similar phenomenon that we, you know, that leaders learn to redefine things as a crisis because that will garner more attention in the long run. So there seems to be a consensus from a lot of different corners that our ability to identify the right individuals as leaders is not always optimal. And I think that's what I would like to get across in teaching as well, is that maybe in the organizations or the teams somebody's involved in, perhaps there's somebody who really has a vital contribution to make, or is already making a vital contribution, is influencing others in a very healthy and positive way, and also kind of shaping a positive outcome for that team without being noticed, because, you know, they don't fulfill our stereotypical Hollywood-esque notion of what a leader should look and behave like. And maybe that happens to be they themselves, you know, because how we talk about ourselves, the story we tell about ourselves, is of course also immensely powerful. And if you yourself don't conform to what you think a leader should behave and look like, then you might not take yourself as seriously as you should.
Yeah, I may not identify that way. Fun conversation. You know, again, my mind is kind of on this Musk biography just because I find him to be an interesting character, but Isaacson will say that he manufactures drama. And, you know, how sustainable is that? How sustainable is that, right? It's going to be very interesting to watch. And you do have some of these individuals throughout history who are kind of forces of nature, so to speak, who can kind of move through that, across that river, and they do make a dent. And, you know, of course, to horrible ends and to great ends, but by no means does it have to be that way. And by no means is that the only model that we should be looking to. So, sir, what have you been listening to? What have you been reading? What's caught your attention when you're not writing books and researching all of this very, very cool stuff? What's caught your attention recently that listeners might be interested in?
So I haven't had as much time to read and listen to things as I'd like lately. Yes. Because I've been working on finishing this book. I just ordered Adam Grant's new book, Hidden Talent.
Yep.
That will be out in October this year, I believe. And I'm very excited for that. He's also one of these persons where I'm happy to hear his opinion on anything, because it's going to be good. It's going to be insightful and will change my perspective. So, and this topic, from what I gather, you know, this, you know, how a person's potential can unfold over the course of a lifetime. It's not always about the born genius, et cetera, I don't know. I mean, I'm just really fascinated. I'm curious to read more about this. So
yeah,
I'm eagerly awaiting the arrival of that book.
Well, and for listeners, Adam Grant gave a plug for Martin's book. So you know it's good if he's putting his stamp of approval on this. So we were talking ahead of the recording. I said, that is awesome. Congratulations to get his stamp of approval on a publication. I think it's just an incredible win. So good work on that. And I too, yes, I'm excited to read that. I loved Think Again. His perspective on the world is just another one that's a very important one to pay attention to and to have on your radar. Sir, we will do it again. I really appreciate it. Best of luck with this book. Best of luck with all of the promotion that comes at this point. And thank you so much. Thanks for looking at this topic from a little bit of a different perspective and a very, very important perspective. As always, thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
Be well. Looking a little bit more deeply into an individual's story or the stories that surround the events that occurred when some major shift or difference was made in the world. And when I think of Martin and his really, really good work, as a historian, he is looking at these individuals and the times and the people surrounding these individuals in just a very, very interesting and fun way. We often simplify some of these things to just the heroic version of leadership. But there's much more there. We can lionize an individual like Steve Jobs for the change that he helped facilitate in the world, but there was a cast around him and there were individuals supporting him to make some of that vision come to life. And that vision was co-created with others. It's overly simplistic to just look at Steve Jobs as the only force. Of course, he was a force, and sometimes a challenging one, but we need to look a little more deeply. So, Martin, thank you for the unseen leader. And for listeners, the practical wisdom for me, are you looking at this individual or the team from all angles to really, truly trying to understand what the forces were that caused the shifts to occur? Take care, everyone. Be well. Bye-bye. You have just finished another episode of Practical Wisdom for Leaders with Scott Allen. To contact me, visit www.scottjallen.net or send me a note at scott@scottjallen.net. I can also be found on Twitter and LinkedIn, so let's connect. Now, if you have feedback, I'd love to hear it. And as always, thank you so much for listening. One final nod to our sponsors, the International Leadership Association and the Bowler College of Business at John Carroll University. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.